the Agile brand.
Welcome to the Delighted Customers Podcast, now part of the Agile Brand Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mark Slayton, and I am so glad you're here. I empower leaders to delight their customers, and I talk to guests with a wide range of expertise who share meaningful insights, wisdom, and practical tips that you can use immediately. I'm also excited to announce the Trusted Guide Roadmap Masterclass for CX leaders who struggle with executive buy-in and are ready to go beyond CX fundamentals. The masterclass gives you proven frameworks and takes you step by step through a four-step model that will move you past the frustration of not getting your work done. It's unique because it's live, interpersonal, hands-on, and we give you tools and templates to help you build your CX roadmap. To learn more, visit empoweredcx.com. That's empoweredcx.com. And now, on to the show. Welcome, and I am excited to share this episode that aired in 2023 with one of the most influential people globally when it comes to customer experience, and that is Joe Pyne. In this episode, Joe talks about creating value for customers by providing time well spent and time well invested. The author of The Experience Economy, Joe is truly one of the pioneers of CX and on my Mount Rushmore of CX legends. I think you learn as much as I did, if not more, from one of the CX masters. Let's dive right in. Well, I am so excited to have on my show today, Joe Pyne, a CX thought leader, a speaker, an author, and in my opinion, a luminary in our field. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate those comments.
No, really, I mean it. And we're going to talk more about why I'm saying that. But first, if you don't mind, just introduce yourself to the audience. Let them know kind of what led you up to doing what you're doing today.
Well, I always say I'm an author, speaker, and management advisor, helping companies basically create greater economic value in their business. And I've been doing this for 30 years. In fact, I did a LinkedIn post, 13 days ago, where I said that I had left IBM 30 years ago. Right. So that's what started me on this journey. I was very much a nerd to start out with and worked in IBM and very technical jobs, moved up to management and strategy. And I discovered the concept of mass customization, which is the late Stan Davis wrote a book called Future Perfect in 1987. And when I read it, it was like the heavens opened up and the angels sang, because it explained what I was seeing going on at IBM, that we were designing computers for this general purpose market that didn't exist. And so I worked on getting mass customization into our plans and strategies. And then IBM, as sort of a reward for various work I'd done, sent me to MIT for a year to get my master's degree. And I had an opportunity 5 weeks ago to go back, spent 4 days at MIT with a client doing a few speeches and then touring around, meeting professors and so forth. So just, such an intellectually stimulated environment. It was just great to be there. Yeah. And then when I found out I had to do a thesis, I said, I'm going to do a thesis I can turn into a book. Right. So mass customization was my thesis at MIT. And then when I got back to IBM, I got a book contract to be able to write it. It came out in late 1992. And then in June of the following year, 30 years ago, I left IBM and started to go out on my own. And so I've been talking about that. And it was shortly after that that I discovered the experience economy. So it was like, IBM was my biggest client. I came back and taught their consultants and clients at the IBM Advanced Business Institute out in New York. And I was doing an all-day workshop with a consulting group. And I said something I often do, which is that mass customizing a good, right, a physical good, automatically turns it into a service. Look at the classic distinction. Goods are standardized, but services are customized. They're done for an individual person. Goods are inventoried after production, but services are delivered on demand when the customer says this is what they want. And goods are tangible and services intangible, but part and parcel of mass customization is the intangible service of helping people figure out what it is that they want. Sort of a classic example now I use all the time is have you seen the Coca-Cola freestyle machines and like Five Guys and Wendy's? And
where you can pick whatever flavor. Yeah,
exactly. Right. So, I mean, that's mass customization. You pick whatever flavor you want. You define what it is that you want with the touchscreen, you know, a little design tool that they have. You can mix all the different types of Cokes. You can add lemon and lime and cherry and so forth. And you define what you want. And then and only then does it get put in finished inventory, right? Mm-hmm. You put your cup in there, you press the button, and then you get the Coke that you define, right? So that really, they're really in the service business of helping you figure out what you want with the touchscreen and then delivering only and exactly what you want, right? So that's what mass customization is. So this consultant in the back of the room, sort of a smart aleck, said, well, you talked about service companies that mass customize. What does it turn a service into? And I shot back, mass customization automatically turns a service into an experience. And I went, whoa, that sounds good. Hold on a sec.
Whoa.
Write that down, right? So literally, it was providence. It just came out of my mouth, right? Never thought about it before, but I thought about it a lot afterwards. And I realized that was true, number one, that if you design a service that is so appropriate for a particular person, exactly the service that they need at this moment in time, customized to them, then you can't help but make them go, wow, and turn it into a memorable event, right? And that's what an experience is. It's a memorable event that engages each person in an inherently personal way. And so, excuse me, I realized that experiences, therefore, were a distinct economic offering, as distinct as from services, as services were from goods and goods were from commodities. Excuse me again. And therefore, there would be an economy based off of experiences, just like there is the agrarian economy based off commodities, industrial economy based off goods, service economy. And so that was the beginning of the experience economy, was that, you know, that just flash that came out and starting to think richly about it and what it meant. And that led to several articles beginning in 1996, including a Harvard Business Review article in 98 that got a lot of attention called Welcome to the Experience Economy. And then in 99, we published the first edition of the Experience Economy with the subtitle Work is Theater and Every Business is Stage.
Okay. And then since then, so bring us forward to today. Since then, you've written other books, you collaborated with other books, and then, yeah, bring us up to speed.
So I wrote that book with my partner, Jim Gilmore, who became my, right after IBM, then he became my biggest client when he worked for CSC Consulting. And we did research together. And so we decided he left and joined me. And we took another partner from CSC called Doug Parker, who was our managing partner and does everything else. So we came out with the book. We then started, you know, doing a ton of speaking workshops again, consulting with companies on it. One of the things we recognized was that, particularly on trips to the Netherlands, right? I've been to the Netherlands, you know, probably three dozen times. I was a visiting professor at the University of Amsterdam for a while, and whenever I would talk about experiences, they would always ask a particular question at the end, and it was actually less a question than an accusation. And I always began with the same two words, you Americans. The Dutch would say, you Americans, right? You like your Disneyland, your fantasy, you know, your in your face sort of experiences. But we Dutch, we like our natural, authentic experiences. And this happened so often, I got to thinking about it and sort of developed a practice response, which involved telling them that they're wrong. it's interesting getting this question because you come from a country that's ever bit as fantasy as Disneyland is, right? That it's not a natural place, right? You 2/3 of the country you've recovered from the sea. You go for a walk in the woods. It's the only place where I've ever been. Walking in the woods and all the trees are lined up in rows, right? Because they plant their forests, right? It's not, you know, and they'd always go, and then they realize I'm right, right? But what it said is that there really is this desire for authenticity. Sort of like everybody around the world wants to think that the experiences they have are authentic, even if they're different than everybody else's. And so what Jim and I realized is that authenticity is really becoming the new consumer sensibility, we call it, the primary buying criterion by which people choose who to buy from and what to buy. And it just naturally arose with the rise in the experience economy because of the fact that, as life becomes more and more of a paid for experience, we just question what is real and what is not. And increasingly, people don't want the fake from the phony, they want the real from the genuine. So in 2007, and just on LinkedIn today, somebody posted a book review of it, you know, even though it's from 2007, We came out with Authenticity, What Consumers Really Want. And so if your listeners are interested in that, they should look up that book. We updated the experience economy in 2011. It was the first time it came out in paperback because for those 12 years, it kept selling. You know, one of the secrets of the book industry is when a book comes out in paperback, because nobody buys it in hardcover anymore. And so they lower the cost and hope more people buy. So we didn't come out with it until 2011 when we decided to update it. And in the first edition, we talked about the emerging, the forthcoming, the nascent experience economy. Here we said, in 2011, we said it's here, right? We're now in the experience economy. You can see that it's happening. In 1999, and for years after it, I had to argue with people that it was happening. By 2011, I just say it and everybody gets it, right? Because it's in the air that we breathe, right? We see it all around us, particularly after the pandemic, where we realized that, you know, as we don't need more stuff, even if it's ordered online and delivered contactlessly. What we missed during the pandemic was the shared experiences that we have with our family, with our loved ones, with our friends, our colleagues, and even with complete strangers. So you can see that basic shift going on. 2011, I also wrote a book called Infinite Possibility, Creating Customer Value on the Digital Frontier, to talk about how you fuse the real and the virtual at the beginning of augmented reality, virtual reality, and all that. So I talk about that in there. And then 2020, we re-released the experience economy, released it for the third time, with a new preview on competing for customer time, attention, and money. Because time, attention, money are the currencies of the experience economy. That's what you're battling for. And therefore you need to get into the experience business, or your goods and services are going to be commoditized, which puts you where you're competing against the world for the time, attention, money of individual customers. So we talk in there how to go about it, in particular about how create and stage experiences that are robust, cohesive, personal, dramatic, and even transformative, right? That those are the five key elements of experiences. So there's been a lot of other stuff in there too that I've written and thought about, all this sort of, I liken it to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? I got this universe of thought that I keep expanding out in different directions, but those are the highlights, Mark, probably more than one.
I love it. And I want to double tap on a whole bunch of it because there's a lot to unpack on what you just shared. But before we do, I am a fan of many others, but a fan of Strengths Finders, Gallup, Clifton. Yep. And one of mine is ideation. And I'm guessing you may also share that in your top five strengths is ideation. Have you ever taken this?
I love ideating. I love ideating on behalf of clients in particular, and thinking of new ideas. What I say is my fundamental strength, which actually goes back to my applied mathematics degree, where I had a class on model making. But the primary thing that I do is one, that's pattern recognition, right? Mm. Seeing what's going on in the world and seeing the patterns, connecting dots, and say, okay, this is significant. And you know, sometimes I like to say that I can develop a trend off of a data point of one, right? Because even one company do something and say, you know, that's something. I can see how other companies could do that. And then two, the model making is developing frameworks that first describe what's happening and then prescribe what companies can do about it, right? And that's what I did first with mass customization, which is now, you know, like this huge thing that companies are doing the world over. Secondly, with the experience economy, and then on and on with the other concepts. Right? Figure out what's going on, develop a model, explain to companies, this is what's going on and this is what you can do about it.
Yeah. And so if you were paying attention as you delineated your work history and your book history, if you notice the years that he was talking about, Joe is ahead of his time, and a futurist in that sense, another one of the strengths. So when I go back and I think about customer experience management, you know, I'm the board right now, I'm serving on the board of directors of CXPA, the Customer Experience Professionals Association. Well, what you were talking about was way ahead of that. CXPA didn't start till 2011, 2012, right? And so
I remember the first annual conference you had. I think it was Bruce Temkin, if I remember, but I donated, it was right after the updated edition came out. So I donated like 20 books for them to give out for various things at the conference. I think Bruce was the one that requested it, but I'm not positive.
Yeah. Well, and so what I was going to say, speaking of Bruce, I've had some people who go back, you know, to that time and before on my show. I've been fortunate enough to have people like Bruce Temkin, Rob Markey, Lou Carbone on the show. And they always refer back to the experience economy and Joe Pine. So what I'm curious about is, and I may have asked you this last time we spoke, was, you know, where did this word customer experience or employee experience or experience management, like, were you, when you just shared that story about service into an experience, you know, was that really, and then you built on that over the next few years, was that really the first that we came to know customer experience management?
Yeah, I think so. And then when I started publishing about it, I always felt like the customer experience movement came out of that focus on experiences. And when we came out with the book, it really did that. I would also cite Lou Carbone's book, Clued In, which I think was one of the first to really look at how do you turn things into experiences, right? How do you make experiences out? He didn't talk about experiences as a distinct economic offering, but sort of everything but. So I think that was the other key thing. And then other books then followed off of there. So I Lou deserves a lot of credit as well.
Yeah, no question about it. So going back to the experience economy, in the book, and you say, I love this, work is theater and every business is a stage. Every business is a stage. I love that because while I have absolutely no talent when it comes to theater, my wife and kids have tons of talent in that area. So I love to go watch. And I do say that without fans, there is no theater. So I'm one of the fans. And the book says, you know, in the subtitle of the book demonstrates how goods and services are no longer enough. What companies must offer today are experiences. This is going back to 1999. Yeah. Memorable events that engage each customer in an inherently personal way. It further shows that in today's experience economy, companies now compete against the world of time, attention, money of individual customers. So could you say more about that?
Right. Well, The very notion is that with experiences, what's the economic function, right? You extract commodities and trade them on the open marketplace. You make or manufacture goods, right? And then put them in inventory. You deliver services with that individual person that's there in your factory, so to speak. So with experiences, it's staging. You stage experiences. What does that mean? It means that you are intentional about everything, that you design every element intentionally to be able to engage people, right? And that happens inside of them, right? That's where the experience actually happens, is inside of us in reaction to the events that are staged in front of us. So once you start talking about staging as the key economic function, well, then it's just natural that work is theater, right? That you and theater is being intentional about everything you do. Theater is about how you do what you do. So you may have the same functional requirements, the what's may be the same, but how you go about doing that can turn any mundane interaction into an engaging encounter. So I always say with companies that the first thing to think about when you want to get experiences is theater, because it requires no capital equipment. It merely requires that you understand that work is theater, that you direct your workers to act, and then you give them the wherewithal to act on your business stage. So Mark, right now, whether you know it or not, you are acting, right? You have an audience out there, as you said, and you are being intentional about what you did, maybe choosing what you wore today. I, for example, actually changed my shirt. I've got a golf match this afternoon. I was wearing a particular golf match, a golf shirt, but it has stripes in it, right? And I know stripes don't work well. Don't work well on Zoom and video. So I intentionally changed my shirt to give the right impression of being out here. I always remember famed stage director Peter Brook once wrote a wonderful book called The Empty Stage, and a short little tome. But the opening line is, he said, "I can take any empty space and call it a bare stage. A man walks across this stage while someone else is watching him, and that's all that is needed for an active theater to be engaged." Right. So to your point, it requires people watching, right? Or knowing that they're going to watch in the future, such as with this recording, right? If people are watching and you're working, you're on stage, right? Whether you know it or not, whether you do it well or not, you're acting and need to act in a way that engages the audience.
So that is really interesting. And I think about, you know, for organizations and business leaders or CX leaders, if they think about their customers and the experience that they have, what you're saying really is, I mean, it kind of is looking at the journey that they go through as the theatrical act, and then how you intentionally purpose the different aspects of that journey in a way that creates an experience that it creates value for their time, attention, and money that they're willing to trade off.
Right, right. That they're willing to spend their time with you. They're willing to give you their attention. They're even willing to pay for the experience, ideally explicitly through an admission fee or a membership fee or some other way of charging for time, right? That's what you do with experiences, is you charge for time. And as you said, the other aspect of theater is that journey you're talking about. And I like to phrase it as its dramatic structure. Right, it's dramatic structure, right? The intensity, the complication, what happens in the experience, you know, has to rise up to a climax and come back down again. If you have a flat experience, right, where nothing else happened, you know, a watchword around CX today is frictionless, right? Mm. And yeah, if you want great service, frictionless is exactly the way that you want to go. But if you want an engaging experience, you want an experience that's memorable, then you need to be frictionful, right? Mm. Frictionful is when things happen, the obstacles happen to get to that you have to overcome in order to get up to that climax and come back down again. So you design that dramatic structure that your customers go through in order to create the engagement and create the memory.
So Joe, let's talk about a practical application. Then I want to go back to a chart that I saw you share in one of your speeches, one of your keynotes, that had sort of these four or five levels, and above the line was, and let me come back to that in a minute, but from an application standpoint, if I'm a bank, right, and I'm a banking customer, there are certain things that I want to have done without a whole lot of friction, right, and drama, right? If I go to an ATM machine to get money out, which I don't do anymore, but people still do that, I guess, or if I go to,
I haven't been to an ATM in a decade myself, but yes, I still get cash, but instead of an ATM, I go to a Julie. I've got a Julie at home and Julie gets cash for me when I need it.
You're lucky. I don't have a Julie.
Everybody should have a Julie. You're wonderful.
What would you say? Cause people, you know, people, we're not talking about creating obstacles and friction that's painful. Can you share, you know, how the practical application of that would look?
So, right. So if you look at banking, I'll say, first of all, no industry is more commoditized itself than banking. Why? Because they came to view spending time with customers as costing them money, right? So they want to push them out of the branches where they're costing us money to use ATMs. They want to push them out to use a phone voice response system. They want to push them out to access it over the internet. They want to push them out, give them an app so they can do everything on their app. And we want that, right, when we're looking for service, right? And services are basically about time well saved, that you save my time in doing this activity, right? And they're absolutely, we want it to be frictionless. We want it to be as convenient as possible. We want to get it done and over as quickly as possible. But what experiences are time well spent, that people actually value the time. So are there times in banking when you're looking for that? Absolutely. I mean, the one example I'll point to, the original ING Direct cafes, they're now the Capital One 360 cafes, right? So now this is them saying, look, here's the opportunity to come spend time with bankers. And we don't have to make a formal appointment. We don't have to get me behind the desk and you out there and so forth, or a teller where they're up on a high stool and looking down on you and that. Instead, let's just have a conversation, right? Let's just informally talk about what you need. And they get people to come in and have that conversation, right? And that's not time well saved. They're actually spending more time with the bank, right? It's time well spent over a cup of coffee. Or what was the other one I was thinking of? Yep, I lost that one.
Well, yeah, so you read my mind when I drew that line, and I was about to go in that direction with my follow-up question, which was, I saw that illustration and I love that illustration. I'd love you to share a little bit more about that, because I think you had maybe good services later below the line. Right. And that works nicely into the question I had previously asked about, you know, how should we design experiences as business leaders? So you talk about, you know, service below the line, time well saved. Sometimes that's what we're looking for, but then time well spent. So talk about when they both apply.
Right. So they both apply, like even all experiences of time well saved aspects, right? If you're going to Walt Disney World for the day, do you want to spend a half hour waiting in line at the entrance to get in and pay your money? No, you want to book in advance. You want to get a magic band. You want to walk up, go dang, boom, you're in. Right. So the service aspects of the experiences should be time well saved. Because all of this is, if you got any technology leaders, right, this is a stack, right? This progression of economic value, as I call it, is a stack. And that experiences are the layer of experiences are built on top of the layer of services. You can't have experiences without having services. And you want those service aspects to be time well saved. Services you can't create without goods, you know, whether they're the tables and chairs at a cafe or a restaurant, the dry clean equipment in a laundry facility or whatever they might be. You have to have goods. You build surround those goods with the service activities of using those goods on behalf of the customer. And goods, of course, are made out of commodities, right? So they're all of a stack like that. And so the line that I draw between services and experiences is that time well saved versus time well spent. Right, services, goods, commodities, time well saved. Experiences, time well spent. And I will make a quick aside, which is, in fact, though, many of the goods that we buy are to enable the experiences that we have. Right, I'm playing golf this afternoon. Well, I've got golf clubs, and the golf clubs enable me to play that experience. You go surfing, you have a surfboard. So just a vast majority of goods we buy, in fact, are for the services that they enable. And so there's one level below that I don't usually draw in that way, and that's time wasted, right? The worst thing you can do is waste your customer's time, right? And companies do that all the time. You know, you call up a call center. This happened to me just the other day, right? I called up a call center. It asked me to provide my account information, right? So they could identify me, even my address and that. And the voice response unit specifically said, so we can pass it on to the representative. But I get to the representative, what's the first thing they ask me for? Right? Is all that information they gave. Yeah. And I specifically said, I already gave that information. And they said they pass it on to you. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I don't have it. I'm just like wasting my time. Do that over again. Or you go to a doctor's appointment or hospital. The first thing they do is they give you a form to fill out of information they already have.
Right.
It's the same thing. So yes. You've got to stop wasting customers' time, and then you turn that into time well saved, right? Then you've got time well spent. And again, that's the province of experiences. Ideally, you are charging for the time because you are what you charge for. If you charge for undifferentiated stuff, you're in the commodities business. If you charge for tangible things, you're in the goods business. If you charge for the activities your people perform on behalf of the customer or the client, then you're in the services business. But economically, you're in the experience business if and only if you charge for time, right? Because that's what people value. And so I always use Starbucks as a great example because you can see the coffee progression. It starts off as a commodity worth 2 or 3 cents per cup, turn it into a good that you buy at the grocery store worth 5, 10, 15 cents per cup. You go to a vending machine or a corner diner, bodega, 7-Eleven somewhere, now you're paying 50 cents, $1 or $2 per cup. but you buy that cup and spend time in the ambience and theater of a Starbucks, and now you're spending $4, $5, $6 per cup of coffee. But Starbucks gives away the experience to better sell the coffee, right? They charge a premium for it. But eventually you have to align what you charge for with what your customers value. And that is the time that they spend with you. That's that time well spent aspect.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that illustration of the coffee bean, because the bean is 2 to 3 cents, right?
Right.
But by the time you're changing the way it's consumed, it's an experience, and that becomes time well spent. We only have so many hours in a day to live.
Exactly.
So when you can change, you know, your offering to time well spent, like Starbucks, then you can charge for it. And you just gave the financial business case for getting to that point. So I really like where we're traversing to bring it to reality. You wrote an article about a year with collaborator, an article called The New You Business.
Right.
That was published in HBR in February of 2022. And you say companies and economies create more and more value as they shift from selling commodities to manufacturing goods, to delivering services, to staging experiences. Transformations extend this progression to the fifth level, where companies help customers achieve major change. Say more about that.
Yeah, so transformations is that fifth and final economic offering. Mm-hmm. As a stack, again, it's built on top of experiences. It's why I said earlier that you want to create even transformative experiences, right? Because we only ever change through our experiences. As the saying goes, we're all the product of our experiences. And we can, and companies can intentionally design them to help us create that major change, to help us meet our aims, our goals, our ambitions, and particularly most generally, talk about our aspirations. So I go to a golf coach to help me, turn me into a better golfer, a single digit handicap golfer, for example. I go to a fitness
center. I've tried that and it hasn't yet worked, by the way.
It did for me, and then I went back and now I'm coming down. But anyway, you go to a fitness center in order to lose weight, or to Weight Watchers or other companies, or get the new map in order to lose weight. We all have these aspirations, and certain industries are fundamentally about transformation, not about goods and services, right? And what I like to use is Ben Franklin's famous phrase that businesses, they're in the business of helping people be healthy, wealthy, or wise, are in the transformation business. Mm-hmm. And just to come back again to what you talked about earlier, wealthy means banks, means financial advisors and so forth. And while banks, they tend to talk about their products and services, and they say it like it's one word, right, with five syllables, products and services.
Yeah.
So that's six syllables. And and even though they don't have any products, right, there's no physical goods that they have other than brochures. There's no nothing they sell that has a physicality to it. But yet they lump it together because, I mean, it's packaged. It's sort of, they commoditize the services themselves by turning them into products. And instead, they need to think about going beyond products and services to experiences and transformations. That money effectively is a means to an end. There are a few people for whom it is the end, but money is a means to an end for most people. And if you can sell the end rather than the means, then you can gain much more economic value. And transformation, we talk about time well saved, time well spent. Transformations are time well invested. Right, that people are investing their time in those time well spent experiences in order to pay dividends and compound interest now and into the future. Right, that's what we're looking for with transformations.
Yeah, and so you talk about businesses partnering with consumers to improve some fundamental aspects of their lives to achieve a new you. That's the title of the article, right?
Right, right. It is. It's about a new you. It's that you have particular aspirations you want to achieve. And then one of the other things we say in there is change is incredibly hard to accomplish on our own, right? It's difficult to change, whether it's to lose weight or quit smoking or get better at golfing or tennis or boating, you know, whatever it might be. And so we hire people, we hire companies to help us do that, to help us achieve those aspirations to become that new you. So it's a huge opportunity in healthy, wealthy, and wise industries and beyond to think about why your customers want your offering, right? That's the key. I talked about how services are the what and experiences the how, right? That's what the theater aspect to it. With transformations, you need to think about the why, right? Not why you're in business, although of course that relates, but why is your customer buying this? What it is it that they really want? And then sell the end rather than the means to which your offering is the means.
So sort of thinking about what's your customer's goal? Like what do they want to achieve by using or interacting with you and your products or services?
Right, exactly. Right. What is their goal? And it's going to be as individual as every customer you have, right? We can talk about generically fitness centers take people from flabby to fit. Healthcare generically from sick to well. Financial services generically from where they are today, which may be poor or otherwise, but too wealthy, right? That's where they're wealth advisors, and they want to make you wealthy. But every individual has a particular reason, right? I may go to a financial advisor because I want to retire well. I may go to a financial advisor because I want to be able to send the kids to college. I may go to a financial advisor because I want to have a big vacation every year and be able to put away money to be able to afford that, and so on and so forth. We'll all have our individual, often idiosyncratic reasons. So you need to find out that why. You know, the first step of a transformation I like to call is diagnosis, right? Diagnosis. Who is this customer? What do they want to become? Where are they today, right? Then when you've got that gap between their aspiration and their state today, then you can design the set of experiences that take them to that level, right? And often there's some backsliding in there, right? Like you know, I was above below single on single digit, now I'm above single digit, got to get back again. You have that, and so you design the set of experiences. And the third thing you need is follow through, and follow, not follow up, which is hi, how you doing, but follow through, which is ensuring that the transformation takes hold, right? If I quit smoking, go through a transformational quit smoking program, and then 3 weeks later I light up again, I wasn't really transformed. You've got to ensure that it stays through time.
Good. It's a really important point, because whatever industry or business you're in, sometimes people think even the experience ends when you've sold the product or service, yeah, and you got paid for it. And that's really not true.
Right. Yeah. Right. There's always things that you can do after that create even more value.
Yeah. So great conversation, so much good stuff. I hope if you're listening, you've got some real practical applications out of this. And I hopefully in that last discussion that we just talked about, even if you're a middleman, you're a wholesaler, if you're selling, forgive me, widgets, somewhere in that process that aren't quite as transformative as a Disney World or a fitness expert or a wealth management person, you could still get the main point, which is you are serving someone. What are their goals, and how do you build value for them and personalize the experience? Right.
Right. Exactly. Is thinking about that next level, and I like to say B2B companies should, in particular, think about the transformation level. Think about going up that chain to provide more value for the customer, because no company ever buys their offerings because it wants their offerings. It's always a means to an end, right? So again, you work towards those ends. Why do they want that offering? And go from just delivering widgets, as you say, to someplace to category management and managing the entire category, right? Not you, where you don't have to have people that'll put this in place. We'll do that. We'll put it on your shelves. We'll put it in your lot and so forth. And then what the next level that we can do to help them become a better business, right? That's what they want. They want to become a better business.
Okay. All right. Terrific. And you and I talked about a concept that that is fresh for you and something you've been stirring the pot on a little bit, and we may be hearing more from you on. And I love it because you're a thought leader and you ideation is definitely in your top five. You're ahead of all of us. And the concept or the term that you're using is customering. And could you define it for us and talk about the implications for how designing experiences could apply to marketers?
So my partner, Jim Gilmore, I just did a masterclass here in Minneapolis last month on this topic. And the basic idea I understand is that there are no markets, only customers. Right? Markets are a fiction we tell ourselves. We don't know who our customers really are. But a customer isn't part of a market or a segment or a niche or a demographic or a persona, right? All of those are groupings of customers that do not exist. A customer is an individual living, breathing person. Or if you're selling to other companies, they're an active corporeal individual entity. And so we need to ascend to the proposition that all customers are unique, unremittingly, undeniably, unarguably unique. And therefore, we need to stop marketing and start customering. And so that's where the idea comes from, is how do we customer? And I will say, you know, the term marketing's only been around for like 120, 30 years, maybe. And I'm sure that it didn't fall trippingly off the tongue when it was first uttered either. But same with customering, but that's what we need to do. And involves a whole lot of different things. You know, one of the fundamental principles of customering is to go from push to pull, right? Is stop making stuff and pushing it out, putting it on shelves, putting it in inventory, and instead pulling from customers what their individual wants are and doing something different for them. So that then harkens back to the mass customization, that because you want to do so efficiently, right? Mass customization is efficiently serving customers uniquely. So you want to do exactly what they want, give everybody what they want, but do it at a price they're willing to pay. And so you pull that information from them, you pull the in-process inventory to produce a product for the customer. Again, think about the Coca-Cola Freestyle machines. They come up, they tell you what they want, you pull that information from them, then and only then do they pull literally, right, pull down the different elements, the fluids, right, that go into your particular drink and deliver it to you. So I think many other things we can go to, and it won't go into all the details, but I'll relate it also back to the progression of economic value, that it's important to do customering there because of if you think about it, commodities, goods, and services exist outside of people. Experiences and transformations happen inside of people. Mm-hmm. Right? It's inside of us where we get engaged and we create that memory inside of us. And then we use those experiences to actually change, then we're changing from the inside out. So experiences and transformations are inside of us. They're inherently individual, unlike the commodities, goods, and services. So part of customering is to go beyond those things outside of us and reach inside of people, engage them, and even transform them from the inside out. The mega trend, right? The one word I like to use that describes this whole progression of economic value is, in fact, individualization. It's about getting more and more individual with customers. With customization being that route up, as we talked about earlier, Mark, that customizing turns good into a service into an experience, and an experience into a transformation, right? If you design an experience that's so appropriate per person, you can't help but make it a life transforming experience. And so that essence of individuality, plus the fact that you're reaching inside of people and engaging them. So customering is a route to really take advantage of this trend of individualization that people really want.
I love that. I love to pull gems out when guests come up with something that they say kind of fast, and I just want to slow down and make sure people have a chance to get that double click on that one, which is, we go from experience all the way to transformation, and the transformation comes back to an internal. Love the idea of these other things, goods, services, products, they're all external. Experiences are internal. I never thought about it that way. That's really cool. Right. I have one other question that I want to ask before my closing question, which I asked all guests, but it is something that came up as you mentioned that last topic. And that is, Joe, you have talked about things big and small in terms of the world of customer experience, big being experience economy, progression of value. These are big concepts, big things. Or you talk about economies and countries and companies, you know, but then we just talked about individuals and impacting people's lives, and we only have so much time, big and small. What's your why? What is your why for being in this profession?
Well, it's what I talked about earlier. My why, my raison d'etre for working in business is to figure out what's going on in the world of business first, and then develop those frameworks to first describe what's happening and prescribe what companies can do about it. So that's what I've done ever since I started on this path with mass customization over 30 years ago.
So but by understanding those patterns and figuring out those patterns so that you can help shed light on where we should be going to make things better, what will come of that? What are the outcomes you would like to think would come out of that?
Well, you know, to state it humbly, I want to change the world, right? Okay. At least the world of business. And then, but it also has a lot of effect on us as individual people, not just on our work. And because fundamentally, and I got this from my colleague, Kim Korn, who helped me write Infinite Possibility, and others, it's about human flourishing. What business is about human flourishing. It's not about making a buck. Right, it's not about targeting people and trying to get money out of their wallet, you know, so to speak. It's about human flourishing. How do we help them? And transformations are the most related to human flourishing because it's help. How do we help us be better people? How do we help us do things that we couldn't otherwise do? How do we help us, you know, self-actualize, as Maslow would say, and become who we want to become? And businesses have that opportunity to do it. And so I'm an apologist for businesses, right? That businesses have been the greatest force for good in the world, right? Particularly since the Industrial Revolution, all the statistics will tell you how much better off we are. And that's all because businesses created value for individual people. And I'm trying to help them create greater value by understanding what it is that people really want and need and desire.
All right. So trying to change the world. I love it. Okay. Last question here. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
What occurs is, I don't have as much advice as a statement, but I tell my 20-year-old self, you won't be a nerd forever.
I love it. Joe, thank you so much for being on the Delighted Customers podcast. If our listeners would like to connect with you or get a hold of you, touch base, what would be the best way?
You can connect with me directly on LinkedIn. Okay. Just look up Joe Pine. I'm on Twitter at Joe Pine. Or you go to our website, www.strategichorizons.com. And if you do a Google search on my name, you'll find that quickly enough. We do have a contact page there, as well as an email that you can use. And for our quarterly Field Notes newsletter, which we do that gives articles out on the experience economy and other emails on our writings and events.
Excellent, and that we'll include that in the show notes as well.
Super,
Joe. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Delighted Customers podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode or any of my other ones, hit subscribe or follow. I've got a lot of other great guests that are coming up and a lot of other great content. I don't want you to miss anything. You can find any links or references on the show in the show notes, and you can find those at my website at empoweredcx.com. That's empoweredcx.com. Also, make sure to check out the other shows in the Agile Brand Podcast Network by going to www.agilebrandguide.com. The Delighted Customers Podcast with Mark Slayton is produced by Missing Link, a Latina-owned, strategy-driven, creatively-fueled production co-op. From ideation to creation, they craft human connections through intelligent, engaging, and informative content.
The agile brand.